Your Bibles to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2. This morning we're going to be examining the first part of this chapter, and it's declaring the truth that God is the God who can reveal mysteries. And then next week we'll be looking at the second half about the specific mysteries that are revealed to Nebuchadnezzar through Daniel. Now, this is one of the chapters that is strongly attacked by liberals. They don't like it, and the main reason is they reject the idea that there is a God who has the ability to reveal and to control the future. Because they reject that, they have to reject this chapter. Isaiah 46:10, among other verses, tells us that the Lord himself has claimed that he has this ability to declare the end from the beginning, and that this sets him apart from every other claim of any kind of God. None of them can do that. The details that we'll find going through this chapter are so precise that those reject that claim it has to be written the second century after the events, because no one could be that accurate. Well, no human can't, but God can. And this is actually in the text to demonstrate it. It was written in the 6th century prior to these events. Them coming true demonstrates this is the character of the true God. Now, the God of the Bible is the creator of everything, and so he exists out of what we call the time-space continuum. In other words, God is not a prisoner of time. He is not a prisoner of space. The gods of the Babylonians, as all pagan gods, any kind of god that's a creation of man's superstition, are subject to that because they're figments of man's imagination, and man can't get past that. That's our experience, and we can't get past this idea. We are within time. We are within space. Now, demons and fallen angels are spiritual beings, and as such, they're powerful. And from our perspective as humans, they seem to have supernatural power. But they, too, are creatures, and therefore, they're also in this time-space continuum. They cannot tell what the future is going to be. It would have to be revealed to them. They can't control the future. Only God can. And that is going to be the point through the first part of this chapter. There is a God who reveals mysteries. It is the God that controls everything, including the future. Now, chapter 2 begins by recounting that Nebuchadnezzar had very disturbing dreams. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the kings gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." So the chapter begins noting that these dreams occurred in Nebuchadnezzar's second year. As I pointed out before, in the Babylonian chronology, the year of ascension is not the first year, it's the year of ascension. The next year is the first year of the king's reign, and so that's how they count their time. And so the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign corresponds with Daniel's third year in captivity and training. And it would appear from the specific events in the chapter that are cited that either this is very near the end of that training or he had just completed that training. Now, the chronology would be something as follows, according to Walvoord's commentary. May, June 605 B.C., Babylon defeated Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish. That set them up to go in June, August 605, to besiege Jerusalem. It falls. Daniel is captured. And so he's taken to Babylon, and his first year of training begins. September 7th, 605, Nebuchadnezzar becomes king. His father, Nabopolassar, dies. And so this is his year of ascension. Nisan 604, Nisan would be corresponding to our March-April. That would be the beginning of the year in Jewish chronology. Would be then the first year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, the second year of Daniel's training. Remember, they would count any part of a year as the year. So then the next year, Nisan 603-602 B.C., is the second year of his reign, the third year of Daniel's training. That's how it ties together. Now, Daniel 1:17 notes that Daniel had the ability to understand all kinds of visions and dreams. What we don't know is whether that ability was somehow manifested prior to the events of chapter 2, or was it the events of chapter 2 that manifested that he had these abilities. We don't know which came first, but he definitely had the ability. Now, note here as well that Nebuchadnezzar has dreams. It's not dream, it's a plural word, dreams. Multiple, reoccurring, or similar dreams. And in a culture where dreams are considered very important, obviously, reoccurring dreams are very important, and they're disturbing, and that's why Nebuchadnezzar can't sleep. It's bothering him a lot. Now, part of the training of the wise men of Babylon was the interpretation of dreams. They actually kept books on it. Someone would have a dream, they would chart what happens, and so they had all these books they kept for many years, and so if someone said, this is what I dreamed, they would consult their books to see, oh, this someone else dreamed this, this is what happened, here's the interpretation. That was part of their training. But the reality is all they're really doing is making educated guesses at any meaning of the dream. And the king is so troubled, he's not sleeping, he's anxious to know the meaning of the dream, and so he calls in all these various groups that make up the wise men's counselors. He needs to know, does this mean? What's going on? Well, verse 2 lists four groups that make up what we call the wise men. The magicians, that comes from a word that refers to a stylus or pen, and so it may refer to those who write. These would be the sacred historians and the scribes. Then there's a word we translate as conjurers. These were involved with occultic and demonic necromancy, that is, speaking to the dead, trying to get information from dead people. That kind of stuff still goes on. Seances, that's what that's about. The particular word can also be, and often is moved into astrology, that they would look at the stars, the position of the stars. And in fact, the whole culture was very keyed into that. Zodiac, your zodiac signs, it traces back to Babylon. Okay, that's where all that came from. Astrology was very important. Not astronomy, astrology. Charting the positions and saying this is going to happen. They thought everything was determined by the position of the stars in heaven. So they would be part of that. Sorcerers refers to those who use incantation and cast spells. That would be part of the pagan religion. And then there was also the Chaldeans. Now that's a curious word to use because the Chaldeans are a group of people, an ethnic group in southern Babylon. They were, you could say, the heart of the Babylonian Empire. The king was a Chaldean. But the term is also used for the priestly caste. Those in the religion, this is the priestly caste, so that's what this is referring to. Therefore, they're the wise men. Now, these wise men all assemble before Nebuchadnezzar, and they ask him, tell them the dream. You're anxious about this? We'll tell you. Tell us what the dream is. And it would have been his hope that among all these wise men, someone would explain it to him. But he's going to find out that they can't. Now, the last thing to note before we go to the next verse is that Daniel's friends are not there. We go through this whole chapter. They are not present. Now, we know in chapter 1:19 that they enter the king's personal service after they have completed their training and been questioned by the king. And that's why we can say this may be occurring right at the end of his training because he's not there, or he had just finished it up and he's not included yet as those actively serving the king. It's somewhere in that time period. But Daniel's not there. It's all these other ones. And the king doesn't quite trust them. So though he's anxious to know the meaning of the dream, he's also aware these wise men can say about anything he wants, they want, about the dream. They can make up anything, and how would he know the difference? He wouldn't. And so he asked them to do something very difficult. Look at verse 4. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and by the way, from this point all the way through chapter 7, in the original languages, it's all Aramaic. It was Hebrew before, it'll be Hebrew from chapter 8 on, but from this point on, everything's in Aramaic. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever, tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the command is for me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. Now, the Chaldeans are speaking on behalf of all the wise men. And they ask the king, tell us the dream, we'll interpret it, because that's the way it's normally done. But Nebuchadnezzar demands they tell him the dream, and then they interpret it. Not only that, but if they don't do it this way, you're going to have a really nasty death. Being torn from limb is not a nice way to die. Not only that, I will dishonor your memory in a very graphic manner. The NAS is nice and puts rubbish heap. It actually means basically public latrine. It's a dung pile, and that's what your house will be used for. That's not very nice. But at the same time, if you tell me the dream and you interpret it, you're going to get great riches and honor. So he has both the club and a really nice carrot. Problem is there's no way for them to get the carrot. They're in a predicament. Now, that's part of the danger of serving a despotic king. If he likes you and you're in his favor, hey, it's great, wonderful rewards. But if he turns against you and you fall out of favor, your life could be very short. They're in a difficult position. Now, in verse 5, there is some difficulty in translating the particular phrase there, and some have thought that the king may have forgotten the dream, and that's why he wants them to tell him what the dream is. But that doesn't even make sense, because if that's what he meant to tell the wise men, then they'd know immediately he doesn't know what the dream is. They can make anything up they want. Instead, they're afraid. Their lives are on the line. They're scared. They know the request is impossible. Look at verse 7. Verse 7. And they answered a second time and said, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me the interpretation. So right at the end there, he tells you exactly why he's requiring this. Now, his response here the second time is worse than even the first, because he reveals basically is, you guys are a bunch of liars and I don't trust you. That's not too good, is it? Your life is threatened, and he knows that you're liars. He also makes it here is that the accusation the king makes is you're bargaining for time, or literally buying time, because you've made some sort of agreement with each other to lie and speak corrupt words. Now, that could have only happened if they'd had at least a little time to confer, so there's at least a little time has gone by. And they have talked, they've conferred, and he says, this is what this is about. You're just trying to delay things because you know I'm going to be firm in this. Now, the only way they could prove themselves to be truthful is to tell the king the dream and its interpretation. But they did not have that ability. They're in deep trouble, so they make a third appeal. Look at verse 10. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Now, the Chaldeans are speaking again on behalf of the whole group, and they point out no one could do what the king is asking. In addition, they point out that no great king or ruler has ever asked any of them to do this kind of thing before. Now, that's kind of buttering up the king. You want to be a great king, a great ruler? Then you need to be acting like all the other great kings and rulers. They never asked this, so why are you? Now, for some reason, they leave out the sorcerers. We don't know why, but they are not included in the list. Maybe kings have asked sorcerers that in the past. But either way, their declaration at the end is true. They point out, only a god could fulfill this request. No human can do it. And that's impossible because the gods don't dwell with humans. So this is a difficult task? That's an understatement. Now, the king's decree in this is forcing an admission. We can't do this. Only something supernatural, only a God could do this. This is right where God wants them. It's forcing this acknowledgement that will end up being attributed to the God of Israel when he does it. Verse 12, the king's reaction. The king became indignant and very furious, and he gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Now the king's response could not have been worse except for executing him right on the spot. And we don't believe he did that. Nebuchadnezzar decrees it, and it would seem that all of them have to be gathered together. Otherwise, when the captain of the guard found Daniel, he just would have slayed him right then. Instead, they're gathering them, and it looks like it's going to be a public execution. This is bad. Now, Daniel's friends are still, even though they weren't present when the king made this demand, they're considered part of the wise men. And this indicates they're, again, they're either at the end of this training or had just finished it. And because of that, the captain of the guards comes looking for them as well. Verse 14, Arioch the captain finds him, and he informs Daniel of the king's decree that they are to be executed. But Daniel answers very calmly and with great wisdom. Look at verse 14. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in. He requested the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Now remember, at this point, Daniel's still a young man. If he was taken to Babylon, and it could have been as early as 14, maybe as old as 17, but within that range, and you're 3 years later, he's maybe 17, 20, 21 at the outside, that's fairly young. And what's being told to him is, the king has decreed, you're going to be executed. Let's face it, most of us, even wise people, are going to be a little nervous about that. Daniel's calm. Notice what he even the questions he asked. We would say is, why does the king want to kill me? That's not what Daniel asks. He asks, why is the king in haste to kill me? It's a different question. Well, why is that a wise answer? Well, actually, it was reasonable for the king to kill them all, wasn't it? I've just proven you're a bunch of liars. You've been telling me for years you have supernatural powers. You can interpret dreams, and I've just seen you can't do this. You don't have the ability. You're a bunch of frauds. Off with your heads. That could be reasonable. Daniel's only claim is it's unreasonable. It's a hasty thing to issue an execution order for my and my friends, and we've never even spoken to the king about this, and we've had no opportunity to even try to fulfill the king's wishes. That seems hasty. So Arioch explains everything that happened to Daniel. Now that in itself says Daniel already had found some favor with Arioch, however they had met. How much time, if you were sent out by the king to do executions, just gather them, are you going to give to someone who's condemned to death? You going to spend a lot of time with them? Probably not. You going to pay much attention to them? Nope. You're condemned, cuffs on you, you're being led away. I'm not wasting my time with you. You're going to die. And all I want to do is do what the king says so that I'm not included with the group. Right? You got a despotic king here. So Daniel's answer is wise. It's very calm. Well, Daniel is allowed to speak to the king. And in doing so, he simply requests the king for more time. Give us some more time and basically let us see if we can solve this for you. For whatever reason, the king would not allow that previously. But with Daniel, he does. He gives him the time. He gives him the request. Now, perhaps Nebuchadnezzar had calmed down by then. Perhaps he recognized it's a reasonable request. Whatever the reason humanly, God superintended, Daniel gets the time. Now, if you were in Daniel's position, what would you do next? Probably the same thing he did. The king grants the request, you gather your friends, and you're going to start praying. Verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter, in order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Prayer was the only solution, or the only means of finding a solution to this dilemma. So he gathers his friends, and they begin to petition the God of heaven. Now, the request is for really nothing less than a miracle. But it is a request in keeping what they understand of God's character. They know he's compassionate. And they desire to be God, the God to be compassionate to them. That's what they're asking for. Don't let us be destroyed with these other wise men. And the only means of preventing that was God to reveal to one of them the dream and its interpretation. Without that, they were condemned to die. Now, I'm sure they prayed with great fervency, and yet nothing in the text indicates any kind of panic. They're simply placing their future in God's hands. Now, they've already been through a lot, haven't they? They've been through a siege. They've been captured. They've already learned, I can trust God for my life. They're probably already living on what we might consider borrowed time. I should have already been killed. I'm still alive. My life is in God's hands. And so I'm sure with great fervency, and yet without panic, they pray. Now, as a little footnote here, remember I mentioned earlier that astrology was an important part of the religious system. So notice the particular title that Daniel uses for God. The God of, it's actually heavens, plural, the God of the heavens. That's a very specific contrast between the true God and the gods of the Babylonian pantheon. There is the God of heaven, who is over it, and the gods in heaven, the gods controlled by heaven, which would be the pagan gods. There's a big difference there. Now, God was merciful toward them, and he granted the request. Look at verse 19. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel answered and said, Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to the wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power. Even now thou hast made known to me what we requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. Now, it comes in a night vision. Now, the difference between a vision and a dream is that a vision comes while you're awake and a dream comes while you're asleep. Both of them are revelations from God in images of some sort. You're getting a picture of something. And that's what happens to Daniel. Now, the fact that it's a night vision indicates Daniel had not fallen asleep. They were fervent with this. They were diligently praying. And in the midst of praying, God gives them the revelation. Now, when either a dream or a vision comes from the Lord, it is a supernatural revelation. Okay? And that's important here, that it's from God. It's not just a dream. It's just not a vision. Let's face it. All of us have had dreams of one sort or another. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're bad. Sometimes they wake you up. Sometimes it wakes up everybody else in the house because you scream or something because it scared you. And then what's it about? And you don't even remember. But those aren't necessarily from the Lord. This is from God. Daniel's immediate response, he recognized what's going on. He has been given a perception of whatever it was that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed, and he's been given an understanding of its interpretation. And he knows with that, his life is going to be preserved. What's Daniel's response? It's an immediate breaking out into praise. He praised the Lord for his wisdom and for his power. The form and the phrasing in this praise parallels the Psalms. showing that Daniel as a young man had learned the Psalms, because a lot of the phrases come right out of that, or it's parallel in its structure. Specifically, he's giving voice to praise of God because of God's character demonstrated in wisdom and power. Now, God's power is seen in both the control of time and earthly authority. This control is not the fatalistic determinism that was part of the Babylonian religious system. The stars determine everything, and that's how it must be. That ends up in fatalism. Now, we believe God is sovereign, and sometimes we end up that we push sovereignty into fatalism. What Daniel says here is not fatalism. It is the sovereign hand of God, and notice what it says, who changes the times and the epochs. In other words, the circumstances of time and all the points within time are in God's hand, and he changes it however he wants. Now, that's powerful. God, remember, is not existing in time himself. He's outside the box. And too often we start pushing things that it makes sense to us logically. God doesn't have to make sense to us logically. If we want to put God back in the box, we say he's decreed from eternity past what's going to happen, and so it's all got to happen exactly this way. But God's outside of that. He can come in any place he wants and do whatever he wants to do. That's sovereignty. That's our God. He's not in the box with us. And Daniel says this. He changes the times and the epochs. Time as a whole and all points in time are in God's hands, and he turns it wherever he wants. That's a powerful God. Very different than what the Babylonians thought of God. But this is the God Daniel worships. Now, why could he know that? Well, consider just a couple things, and I think we're going to have time this morning, so I actually want to look there. Flip over to Joshua chapter 10. Joshua chapter 10. I want to point this out, and then an incident in 2 Kings of that Daniel would have known about. It's part of his own history of God holding time and doing whatever he wants with it. Now, in Joshua chapter 10, you have the long day. They had gotten into a battle, and the battle's going on, and Joshua knows in order for them to completely defeat the enemies, they need more time. Otherwise, the enemies are going to escape. Night comes, they're going to rest, and we're going to have a tough time tomorrow. We've got them on the run. We need long time. And so he prays, and here's what the Lord gives him. Verse 12, then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves on their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. That's a God who controls things. Now think about that. If you think about that from physical terms, that the sun stops in the sky, what does that mean for the earth? It stops rotating. What happens when you have something that's rotating very fast and you suddenly stop it? And they didn't get thrown off? God's control of all this stuff. That's a powerful God. It's not one miracle. It's a whole bunch of things all in God's hand. Daniel attributes that. He holds time in his hand. And since we don't really understand what time is, we don't understand how God does that. But he does. Let me give you another one. Now that's God stopping time. Look over at 2 Kings chapter 20. 2 Kings chapter 20. Hezekiah has been ill. And in verse 9, God tells him to... Hezekiah asks Isaiah, what's the sign that the Lord's going to heal him? Now here's the sign, starting in verse 9. Isaiah said, this shall be the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or go back 10 steps? Now that's amazing. Which would you like, Hezekiah? What's going to give you confirmation that what God has revealed is going to be true? You want the shadow to go zip forward real fast, or you want it to go backwards? Here's Hezekiah's answer, verse 10. Hezekiah answered, it is easy for the shadow to decline 10 steps. That happens every day. No, but let the shadow turn backward 10 steps. Isaiah the prophet cried to the Lord, and he brought the shadow on the stairway back 10 steps by which it had gone down on the stairway of Ahaz. That's reversing time. It went the other way. This is Daniel's prayer. My God controls time. That's amazing. That's his confidence. God also shows his power over earthly kingdoms as well. And that was all attested throughout the history of Israel. And Daniel would have been very familiar with that. He would have known that the kings were set up, put on the throne when God wanted them there, and removed when God said, that's it. They could have a long reign, or they could have it shortened, depending on God's reaction to them as whether they were godly or not. Hezekiah, for example, was given an extra 15 years. Others were cut short because of their evil. Daniel may have been a captive of Babylon, but the God that he worshipped was the one still in control, and that God had not changed. So Daniel praised the Lord for his wisdom, citing his omniscience and knowing the profound and what is hidden, what is in darkness. He specifically praises God for extending that wisdom to men in general, and then also to him specifically, that he has been given the revelation of this dream and its interpretation. And Daniel makes it clear in this praise that the wisdom that he had, the power that he had, came from God. He claims nothing for himself. All glory, all honor goes to the God that created him. Daniel is humble. And note as well that he is humble that the pronouns here make a reference back to his friends. It says, it is what we requested of thee, not I, we. And that the matter has been made known to us, not just me. Daniel includes his friends. They were diligently praying, and the answer came because of all of that, not because of anything special in Daniel. I think Daniel recognized any of the other three that were there, any of his three friends, they could have also received it. God simply chose Daniel for whatever reason, and he's humble about it. Well, Daniel now goes to try and get this cleared up. Daniel chapter 2, verse 24. Verse 24. He goes to Arioch. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation of the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles of Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. Well, the wise men are still under the king's decree. There's nothing indicating that anything had been removed from that. The king had given Daniel time. Nothing says the other men got any more time. They're still under the order of execution. And so the first thing Daniel does, because he's a man of compassion himself, reflecting God's character, is he goes to Arioch, who's supposed to be carrying out all these executions, and said, stop it. Don't hasten to kill any of these folks. I know the dream, and I can make the interpretation known. So his first act is actually one of compassion. He actually stops the executions of all these other wise men. Now, Arioch believed Daniel, and so he finds a way to somehow gain a little credit for himself. That is the nature of man, always trying to get undeserved glory for yourself. But it's quite a contrast to Daniel's humility. Now, by mentioning that Daniel was from among the exiles of Judah, a couple of things happen. One, it demonstrates that, well, none of these wise men here, so that's why I had to go search them out and find it. And two, it separates Daniel from the other wise men. This is somebody different. So, king, isn't it a good thing you got me serving you because I found the guy? So he's claiming credit for himself. Now, the king answers Daniel, verse 26. King answered and said to Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Now, both his Hebrew and Babylonian names are used to make sure it's clearly identified who he's talking to. It's Daniel. He's very interested in the claim, but he's also clarifying, Daniel, you need to tell me the dream and its interpretation. Can you do this? Daniel's reply is a humble one. Again, he gives all glory to God. And again, he sets him apart from the Babylonian pantheon of gods. Now, he begins by pointing out and reinforcing the fact that all your other wise men, all these other priests, all the ones with the soothsayers, all necromancers, all the stuff they do, they're impotent. They don't have the power. They don't have the ability. And whatever gods they're serving, they don't have the ability. Look at verse 27. Daniel answered before the king and said, As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. They can't do it. None of them. These various wise men, they've claimed special supernatural powers, special abilities, either themselves or as part of their religious practice, occultic practices. And the king's test had proven their claims are utterly false. That's why he was so mad he was wanted to kill them. Whatever supernatural powers they had gained through demons were also limited. And that tells us something else when it comes to spiritual warfare. Demons can't read your mind. If demons could read your mind and had some ability to know what you were thinking, that's not mean they can't make good educated guesses. It's sort of like your mother who reads your mind, or your wife or your husband, you know, they kind of know what you're thinking. They've just been observing. But they can't know exactly what you're thinking in there. If demons had that ability, they certainly would have known what the king had dreamed and what he was thinking about, and they certainly would have revealed it to those that were following them, in which case they could have answered the king. But they can't do that. So take that comfort if you're worried about it or ever considered it. They can't do it. They don't have that ability. So Daniel points out here specifically that they're impotent. They're powerless. The gods they serve are powerless. He now specifically points out there's only one source of the revelation, and its interpretation. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to the king, to King Nebuchadnezzar, what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. Again, Daniel specifically separates the true God from the false gods by referring to him as the God of the heavens. The other wise men, they're incapable because the Babylonian gods are incapable. Their religious system, incapable. There is a God, though, that is capable because he controls the heavens. He reveals mysteries, unlike these pagan gods that are controlled by the heavens. That is the God that has made known to Nebuchadnezzar while he was on his bed the revelation of what's going to take place in the future. And then to emphasize the point of how powerful God is, Daniel not only is going to tell him what the dream was, he tells him what he was thinking about before he dreamed. All right, that's right there at the end. This is what was happening. Your thoughts turned to the future. You started thinking about that. And that's why God revealed to you what's going to happen in the future. God chose to do so. It's also a mild reminder to him that he also is just a man. Verse 30, Daniel's humility once again. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man. But for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. Now, he makes no claim of being or having anything special. That's contrary to what Arioch said. I have found the man who can do this. Like it resided in Daniel. Daniel says, there's nothing special about me. Nothing. I'm no more wise than any other man. The revelation that come to Daniel by God's mercy for the sole purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that he might understand his dreams and visions. Also a gentle reminder to the king. The same God gave you the revelations. It doesn't mean you're anything super special in and of yourself. It's simply God has chosen sovereignly to give you this information. You started thinking about it, and God has chosen to reveal his plans for the future to you by coming through me to the interpretation. It comes through God. All glory is to go to the God of the heavens, not to man. Now, next week, we'll examine the dream itself. But this week, the emphasis is a simple one. There is a God who can reveal mysteries. There is a God who not only knows the future, and can tell you what's going to happen in the future. It's in his hands that he controls the future. That's how powerful our God is. There is a God who is God over the heavens and controls them, as opposed to all these other gods that they were worshiping. They were controlled by the heavens. Throughout Daniel, we're going to see that God is going to continually exalt himself in this manner, because there's all sorts of religions, and each one of them claim their God or gods are somehow superior, some way, some fashion. But there's only one true God, and that is the God of the Bible, the creator of the heavens, the creator of earth, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Only that God is able to review the future with 100% accuracy. Remember, the test was given to prophets back in Deuteronomy. 100% accuracy. If it's wrong on any point, it didn't come from God, false prophet, stone him. That was the test. That's how you know whether it's true or not. That was the test that Nebuchadnezzar was after. If you're going to tell me the interpretation of the dream and I'll know it's true, you're going to tell me the dream. Something's impossible for man. It's going to have to come from the gods. And it did. This is the same God that loved sinful man enough to provide a means of redemption through Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son. He became a man, lived a sinless life, died voluntarily as a sacrificial substitutionary payment for sin. He rose from the dead on the third day. He ascended to heaven. He's made a promise to us. He's returning for those who believe in him. He's made a promise to us that those who believe in him and cast or put their faith on him, he forgives their sins. But it means you have to believe all about who he is and his promises are true. Why can we be assured of that? Because the God who holds time in his hands, controls the future, can be trusted to keep all of his promises, including all those bound up in Jesus Christ. I know where my future is, I know what it holds, and I have no fear of it, because my God holds that future in his hands. That's why when we had the funeral for Dick Burlingame on Tuesday, frankly, it was a celebration. We had some pretty snappy pieces of music going on. Ain't no grave gonna hold this body down. Jonathan and the boys did that for you last week. We did that for a funeral. That's not normally what you think of as a funeral, you know, somber, quiet. No, there is a celebration as well, because we know where Dick is. Why? The promise is there, because our God is this way. So why should we fear the things that come up in life? We don't need to. Our God has his control. Again, what was Daniel's response? He's calm, he's wise, he's discerning, he's not panicked. And he was just told, you're going to get executed. So why then do we get panicked and concerned and about so many things and worry? What is the nature of your God? Only the God of the Bible is omniscient, omnipotent, and sovereign over the future. And because he is, we can be calm, we can have peace. We simply do the same thing Daniel did. Or as Paul expressed it, we are anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let a request be made unto God, and his peace, which passes all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. We are at peace because we know who's in control. I hope that is the God that you're worshiping. If not, you need to consider seriously what kind of God you are worshiping. Tragically, there's a lot of people who claim to be Christians, but their God is not the God of the Bible. They have perverted him, and their God has become limited. What's the God like that you serve? What God do you want to serve? This evening, we're going to be meeting at 6 o'clock for prayer. I encourage you to come out as we simply petition God, same way that Daniel did, based on his character, for his compassion, for his mercies, for his hand in our lives.